Hello and welcome to the If We Knew Then podcast. I'm Stephen Sox.
And I'm Lori Sox.
And today we're joined by Dr. Elizabeth Head, Professor of Pathology, the School of Medicine at the University of California, Irvine. We first met Dr. Head at the T21 conference in June of 2022, and she's dedicated her whole professional life to specifically studying people with Down syndrome when it comes to Alzheimer's and dementia.
I feel like that's one of the big things on that list that we get as parents. And so today we're going to discuss dementia and Alzheimer's, not only in the general population, in our community of individuals with Down syndrome, how they are the same, how they are different, and the hope that lies in the research that Dr. Head is doing, which allows us to participate and not just sit back and take a narrative that is fed to us. We get to be a part of this. We get to understand the disease. We get to seek out medical help. We get to be a part of the research and the trials as well.
And truly advocate for our loved ones.
And support them in self-advocation.
So welcome, Dr. Elizabeth Head.
Good morning. How are you?
Good morning, Dr. Head. Good to see you.
Good morning.
Same. I was just spending part of the morning listening to some of the other podcasts and was really enjoying it. I started listening to a whole bunch of them. I should warn you up front, I love to talk about this, so I'll try to be good. I have a hard stop at 11, but otherwise, I'm all yours.
Well, your research in Alzheimer's and dementia is so pertinent to the journey of an individual with Down syndrome. And I know there's a list of things that they give us as parents when our children are diagnosed, and those become great concerns and worries that we carry with us. And we believe that knowledge can empower us to at least get the supports and to seek what we'll need, you know, to add some kind of ease to the journey or to the challenges. So talking about Alzheimer's and dementia, specifically in individuals with Down syndrome, I think will bring just a lot of insight for people.
Yeah, I always think more information is power, you know, and it makes it less scary when you understand potentially what is happening, could happen. So I love that you're doing this. I think it's great.
Well, I feel like when you say that about information being power, it's just because our fears can take us away. Our fears can go to the darkest places, and then we may never get there, because it's not every individual with Down syndrome has dementia and Alzheimer's. It's just because of that chromosome, that's why there's an increased population. So I want to talk about that. Can Dr. Head, can you this morning just introduce yourself?
Sure. So my name is Liz Head. Please feel free to call me Liz. And I'm a professor and vice chair for research here at the University of California, Irvine, in the Department of Pathology.
What was your initial move toward this subject, from your education on to where you are now?
So it certainly wasn't planned, and it kind of happened spontaneously. So I came to California to do postdoctoral training after finishing a PhD in Toronto, so I'm Canadian. And as I started to learn about Alzheimer's disease, and I worked in a lab that worked with human brains, a pediatric neurologist by the name of Ira Lott came to me, and we got to know each other. And Dr. Lott had a clinic where he was seeing people with Down syndrome. And he'd had this clinic for so long that he was seeing people essentially across their lifespan, and recognized that the development of dementia was very prevalent in his clinic. And there was very little information in the literature about what was happening. So Ira came to me and he said, would you be interested in starting to look at this with me? And at those times, this was in the late 90s, so I've been doing this for a little while, there was, as he mentioned, there was very little in the literature, and it was based on very small studies. And so I started to look, and I became increasingly more passionate about the topic, especially as I became more engaged with families. So I don't have anybody or a direct connection of a person in our family with Down syndrome or a friend, but rather I've made a lot of friends and have met a lot of families in this space that inspire me. And so, again, this has been just a lifelong passion for me.
Well, Liz, what have you seen progress-wise from when you started to now in our understanding of dementia?
So it has been incredible. Just in the time that I've been working in this area, which is almost 25 years. Again, when I was an undergraduate student, we didn't even understand the link between chromosome 21 and the amyloid precursor protein gene on that chromosome and the development of Alzheimer's disease. So kind of watched that whole area evolve. But another thing that's happened and really has exponentially increased our knowledge is the invention of new technology that helps us do better brain scans, be able to see Alzheimer's in a person's brain when they're alive, all the blood biomarkers that are dependent upon these really high-end instrumentation that's been giving us a lot of new leads. So I've seen the field really exponentially increase. And another real driver of this is include funding from the NIH. That investment into research has really benefited, I think, everyone with Down syndrome and their families. So that's what I mean about being inspired. It's such a good time to learn more and more about aging and Alzheimer's disease in people with Down syndrome. But another thing that's been happening is that our knowledge about Alzheimer's in the general population is also dramatically increased. And we can step on the shoulders of giants and apply what we're learning in late onset Alzheimer's disease in the general population and see how that applies and helps us understand the same process in people with Down syndrome. The reverse is also true.
As a parent, I'm in a weird spot, and to be totally transparent, this is how my brain works sometimes. I see a window there for the profession to use subjects that have Down syndrome to maybe have more insight on dementia in the general population. I mean, to me, you're driven by who will fund your research. So, you know, it's a big deal for the mass population to get a hold of this terrible disease. And if they see a way, you know, if someone sees a way, oh, possibly people with Down syndrome could give you a little insight there. I'm not saying, you know, the golden key or something, but who knows? Then we'll go down that avenue. As a parent, there's something in me that says this is pretty great, because a lot of times our children's needs aren't the focus of something. They're put in the back burner of the general population, and here we are brought to the front. I don't care how we got there, brought to the front for research to be concentrated there. It's my hope that when we find a cure or treatment for Alzheimer's, that it hits our population too. And it could be that kids and, I mean, adults with Down syndrome are the first humans that are cured of this disease. It could be, but my hope is that, you know.
Basically, you're afraid that because there's not equanimity in society, because our children still fight for an education, like really fight. Like, I don't believe that society understands how systematic it is that our children with Down syndrome and with disabilities are actually denied their civil right to an education. I do not believe people understand that. I think that they might think it's something else, or, you know, well, they can't do that work anyway, that kind of attitude, but like just the basic right to an education. So I think what you're saying is the fear is that our children are being used to get this information and then to help the general population, because the equanimity of individuals with Down syndrome isn't there, that will just be used like lab rats. That's your fear, and you're saying it very nicely, but that's also your hope in the same breath.
Yeah, there's hope there that here's a part of a pretty intense medical issue for adults with Down syndrome, that there's attention being brought. You know, I feel like if it was specific to Down syndrome, there wouldn't be this push to find a cure, right? So my hope is people with Down syndrome could be in the forefront of being cured. I don't know what your view is on that, but
I could not agree with you more. So when I first started this, in a lot of ways, the only way that we could get funding to support the research for people with Down syndrome was to kind of include it into research in Alzheimer's disease in the general population. So we had to be a little bit clever. And this is why I think the INCLUDE program really focusing on people with Down syndrome is critical to this. So there is some benefit to saying that people with Down syndrome and the way that they develop Alzheimer's disease is very similar to the general population, because again, more people invest and more researchers come on board to work on the problem. But there's also, and what we're learning over time as well, there's some very unique features for people with Down syndrome that we need to not ignore, because there might be some unique treatments that we need to think about in addition to what may work for everybody. So I'm of the mind, I do this research for people with Down syndrome. And in my mind, if it benefits the general population, I'm delighted. But that's not my primary purpose. So, you know, it's really frustrating to me, even to this very day, that people with Down syndrome are excluded from clinical trials for Alzheimer's disease. They're just flat out excluded. And there's really no good ethical reason for that. I understand in terms of research, how do we measure benefit of a drug in a person with Down syndrome? What measures do we include in those studies? How do we screen people into studies? Those were things we didn't know even 10 years ago. But this is where I think the next 5 years is going to be very exciting, because we do have really good ways to diagnose a person very early in the disease. And we know now some possible treatments that will benefit them. And so I'm optimistic in the next couple of years, we're going to learn a lot. Those of us also in the field, you know, we're really very conscious of the history of research for people with Down syndrome. It wasn't for people with Down syndrome, right? And so there's a really, really tough history there that, as a researcher, you know, trying to talk to families, and I would like people to feel comfortable to participate in research. I think we've come a long way. And again, we're very interested in this just for people with Down syndrome. I hope that kind of answered the question, Stephen.
It did. It did. It does prompt a question of how you got to where you were in your mindset of that focus toward, you know, caring that much, I guess, for people with Down syndrome.
I think what really got me was, again, just getting to know the community, just hearing about all the struggles families were having when their loved one with Down syndrome started to develop behavioral cognitive changes. And I was hearing stories that people were reaching out to the Alzheimer's Association, and the Alzheimer's Association, who are fabulous, were saying, oh, no, you need to talk to the Down Syndrome Association, who are also fabulous. But nobody knew really how to address this gap. And, you know, adults with Down syndrome, once they kind of move out of or matriculate from our Down Syndrome Association programs and become adults, we kind of lose them in terms of where are they, what are they doing, you know, what do they need? So I think just talking to families was just, for me, that made it really important to be a focus. And then getting to know some adults with Down syndrome, aging adults with Down syndrome, hearing about their experience of having early signs of dementia, how afraid they are, and there's not a lot of support for them, although it's much, much better. Again, this is an evolving story. Just really spoke to me. I thought this is where I want to be. This is where I think I can really help by doing this research. I'll do as much as I can now and hope the next generation keeps pushing it forward.
You said that individuals with Down syndrome are living longer. Any insights into why that's happening?
I would like to think there's a couple of things going on. One is, of course, that if you manage health over the lifespan, you're going to live longer. So if you reduce your risks for not aging well, like managing hypothyroidism for people with Down syndrome, for example, any other co-occurring illnesses, and keep those under control, that's already going to be a benefit. So I think that improved medical care is a big piece of the equation. I don't think it's the entire piece of the equation. I think an even bigger piece is lifestyle and access and engagement. And, all of those factors come together. They have a biological impact as well to lead to longer lifespan for people with Down syndrome. So I think in my reading of the literature and talking to other researchers who have been in the field for even longer, those would be the two things I think that had the biggest impact.
Can you explain, because we've had it explained, and I think it's really important for families to understand exactly what happens in the brain with dementia, like the difference between dementia and Alzheimer's, and what is happening in the brain and why it affects individuals with Down syndrome at an increased rate. If we can talk about that, because it's not that every human with Down syndrome has Alzheimer's and dementia, just like not every human has Alzheimer's and dementia. And that's one of the things that I want to, it was hard for me to wrap my brain around it. It was hard for me to really understand because there's been so much in my life since Liam was born and diagnosed that there's only like you have to choose what you really understand. Does that make sense?
It does.
I'm going to be honest here because I know he understands a lot of science, but sometimes I get overwhelmed because I feel like information comes at me and I feel like I should know that and I don't, because instead maybe I was writing letters to the school, or instead maybe I was taking care of, flat feet or whatever it is, or making sure there was a good diet there. So I just want parents to understand what exactly is happening in the brain when anyone starts to experience dementia.
Sure. So it's a very, very common question about what's the difference between dementia and Alzheimer's disease. And especially now you hear in the news, Bruce Willis has a different kind of dementia and Wendy Williams was just diagnosed. So dementia is a cluster of behavioral and cognitive signs. So it's like, this is maybe a really poor analogy, but if you have a rash, that rash can be caused by many different things, but the rash itself is a rash, and dementia itself is dementia. What causes it is where the differences lie. So the most common cause of dementia is Alzheimer's disease. And then we have frontotemporal dementia, Lewy body dementia, Pick's disease, a whole host of things that lead to different brain changes. But the readout, what you see in that person behaviorally, is called dementia. So I hope that's a little bit clear. Now, in the general population, the cause of dementia, as I mentioned, could be many different kinds of biological changes in the brain, Alzheimer's disease or others. And sometimes there's a mix, which really makes things complicated. In fact, Alzheimer's disease, pure Alzheimer's disease, as we're learning now, doesn't truly exist. There are other brain changes that are always happening together. For people with Down syndrome, it's almost always Alzheimer's disease. I've seen a few reports of individual people that maybe had some other changes in their brains, but it's very rare. So I know this is going to sound strange, but that's kind of good news, because that means when we think about treatments, we have a better chance, I think, at improving people with Down syndrome because their disease is much more contained. So now Alzheimer's disease is defined by the presence of these beta amyloid plaques in the brain and also these neurofibrillary tangles, plaques and tangles. And the plaques contain a protein called beta amyloid, and the gene that makes that protein is on chromosome 21. Tangles are made up of a different kind of protein, and they fill all the cells in the brain, neurons in particular, and lead to those neurons not working properly. So communication within the brain doesn't work well. And you need both to have, by definition, Alzheimer's disease. So the case for people with Down syndrome is that extra copy of chromosome 21. And so even in utero, little ones with Down syndrome are making too much of this beta amyloid protein. This is a normal protein. We have it in our blood. If you took my blood now, you could measure it. We're not entirely sure what its function is, but we know that in the case of disease, that protein starts to accumulate, and it's and anything around it's very unhappy. It's very toxic. So it's really cool to think about for people with Down syndrome. These are the kinds of questions that we have in my lab. Is across the lifespan, all the way from infants up to in their 30s, we have people with Down syndrome making a lot of this protein, and it should be making a lot of these plaques in the brain, but they don't. So how come? How is it that the body can keep clearing this protein out and preventing it from making those plaques for decades, and then something starts to break in the 30s, and all of a sudden those plaques really start to accumulate? So one of the angles that we're taking in our research is, why is it for all that time that those plaques aren't forming? Is there something else on chromosome 21 that we can focus on, that we can amplify or support? That could be a potential way to prevent Alzheimer's disease for people with Down syndrome. Then in the 30s, those plaques really start to accumulate. And by the time a person is in their 40s, if they have full trisomy, those tangles will start to come on. And then about a decade later, if somebody's going to develop dementia, that's when we start to see at least half of those people show signs. So there's all these opportunities, windows, that we could intervene, be it through a lifestyle intervention, be it through a pharmaceutical, be it through a vaccine, that we can maybe slow or halt the process entirely. And I think we have the best shot at doing this for people with Down syndrome, because all those changes are so tightly bound to age. And in the general population, people develop Alzheimer's disease from 65 all the way up to 102, for example. Really hard to figure out what would be, when would we do a prevention study in the general population. So this is where I think, this is where I'm most hopeful, is I think we have a really terrific opportunity for prevention of Alzheimer's disease for people with Down syndrome. You know, so that's kind of where my focus is on right now, not ignoring all of those people who do have dementia. There's different things that we can think about, but that would be what I'd like to see happen in the next 10, 15 years.
When you say you can measure that protein, does the protein, a measurement in the blood, tell you, you know, how much you're actually building up? Like, if you tested Liam, would he have a higher protein than maybe me? I guess I don't know my future with dementia, so I don't.
Yep. So yes, Liam would have probably more beta amyloid protein in his blood, about 50% more.
Okay.
In the general population, you can measure this protein in the blood without, you know, any problem. It can be affected by a lot of factors, but we're pretty good at measuring it now. But we're learning, there's the whole field has just exploded in the last 2 years, identifying all these new blood markers that might signal if somebody's going to convert in the general population. And we have the Alzheimer's Biomarker Consortium for Down Syndrome longitudinal study that is doing the very same research of looking at blood proteins in people with Down syndrome and watching them over time to see what proteins are predicting if that person might develop dementia and when. So yes, we can measure it in blood. We can also measure it in cerebrospinal fluid. I'm less fond of that approach for people with Down syndrome, as you can imagine why. But we get an interesting reverse relationship. So in the cerebrospinal fluid, we'll see that beta amyloid protein go down as somebody develops Alzheimer's disease, because that protein's being captured in plaques in the brain. So it pulls it out. And so when you have lower beta amyloid protein in your cerebrospinal fluid, that's telling us we have more plaques in the brain. The other way we can look at plaques is through PET imaging. which is pretty incredible. That's another thing that came online over the last 15, 20 years that just revolutionized the field and is getting us closer to treatments and prevention trials.
Why would you avoid the spinal for individuals with Down syndrome?
Oh, only out of experience. It's been a little bit more challenging. It's challenging for any clinical trial, frankly. Not everybody's comfortable with that procedure. So nothing specific for people with Down syndrome. It's a challenging approach. What I'm hopeful is that all of our studies in neurotypical and everybody, I'm hoping we can move away from spinal taps and focus entirely on blood. That makes things a lot more accessible to everybody who's not, say, living in a big city, who's living rurally or in different countries. That makes it far more accessible for everybody.
What part are you focusing on? It seems like there's, like you said, there's so many aspects of it where you could, you know, work on the younger person with Down syndrome that's somehow stopping this protein from accumulating, or also once it has accumulated, like how to get the protein out, you know?
Mm-hmm. I think what I've been learning is the lifespan approach is turning out to be incredibly helpful. So in ABCDS, our longitudinal study, we follow lots of people with Down syndrome and we talk with their families to find out what were the earliest signs of change and being able to predict if a person will develop dementia and when. And, you know, there are still a subset of people that we're watching very carefully who haven't developed signs of dementia and they're getting quite old. So, but the other part of the research that I'm more actively engaged in is, you know, we're setting up a framework where we know how to detect dementia in people with Down syndrome. We know learning and memory tests to use to show a drug might be helpful or not. We know what neuroimaging, you know, brain pictures we can take to help us understand if a treatment works. And I can go on and on and on. We have all these great measures now to use in clinical trials. So the next big question is, what do we do? What is the target, right? And so my work really is focused on figuring out what the target is. And the target is, it's a moving target. So depending on the age of a person with Down syndrome, for example, if somebody's in their late 20s, early 30s, beta amyloid plaques would be my primary target. If they're in their 40s, we have two targets now. We have plaques and tangles to think about. But there's other things that are changing in the brain even earlier or potentially later that we need to understand. So, for example, inflammation is a very consistent feature for people with Down syndrome, both systemic and also in the brain. And when does that happen? Is it very early? Does it drive Alzheimer's disease, or does it come on later? So if we were thinking about a treatment study, should we be targeting inflammation as a way to prevent Alzheimer's disease or to reduce the impact of that disease? So, and the way that I do that is a lot of molecular biology. And it depends a lot on amazing brain donors. And we look very carefully at different proteins in the brain to see when and how things change so that we can design clinical trials and pick the right targets. And I don't know yet if those targets might be slightly different than in the general population. So far, our work suggests a lot of the targets are going to be the same, but we're starting to see some very interesting targets that might be a little different.
What are ways in lifestyle that can help to address the occurrence of dementia?
There's beautiful literature on this in the general population. And there's a lot of epidemiological studies showing that people who exercise, who have a rich social life, who eat, for example, the Mediterranean diet, lots of great evidence that reduces risk for dementia. The literature in the Down syndrome world is far less. Actually, it's virtually, there's very little of it right now. But I'm happy to say there's a lot of great people working on it right now. So stay tuned. And I, I would love to tell you some names of people to talk to. But we're learning more about physical exercise, you know, whether a person lives alone in group home or with family, what differences that might impact on how they age, how they might impact our blood proteins, for example. So I think it's unequivocal that exercise, social engagement, and just keeping your brain active. It's a theme that you've been hearing, I'm sure, everywhere. I see it pop up on CNN every once in a while. It's like, how to prevent Alzheimer's disease. Yeah, we do that. A very, very important thing and is, you know, just to keep on top of all the health concerns. There's some risk factors that people with Down syndrome are protected from. They do not develop. Like hypertension is very rare in people with Down syndrome, and it's a major driver of dementia in the general population. So, you know, but there's other vascular or blood vessel changes that happen in the brain in people with Down syndrome that seems to be actually a little bit worse than what we see in the general population, which is why I think physical exercise is critically important here, is got to keep those blood vessels in your brain really healthy. So those would be the little clues. And I think anytime you can combine those things, the better.
So for the most part, the same preventive medicine that anybody would do as far as diet and exercise and socialization, you can really look at all of those things and understand why there would be an uptick in individuals with Down syndrome, because the diet, like Stephen has said, oftentimes if there's a birthday party that Liam's invited to, maybe he's not included in all the games, but when it comes time for the cake, they cut him a healthy slice. You know, when it's socialization, fight for inclusion, your children should be included in a classroom. That's their civil right to access, you know, an equal education. And that will change. I think that not only changed the brain development, because your brain changes as you learn, right? If you're feeding it and learning, doesn't it grow? And wouldn't that like affect the
just your brain health in general? It can, if you provide your brain with all those things, it can buffer more and more damage. So we know, for example, people who are very highly educated have a lower risk for Alzheimer's disease. And it could be because their brains can buffer that. If they develop it, they can buffer it longer. So, I couldn't agree with you more that having access to all of these activities should be a priority. But I would also put a little additional emphasis on just managing those co-occurring illnesses, because something that we saw in one of our studies, actually was when I was at the University of Kentucky for 10 years, we were doing basic blood work for people as part of the research project. And we were seeing a lot of people where their hypothyroidism wasn't well controlled at all, for example, or they were vitamin D deficient. And, you know, these are things that we know are going to lead to problems in brain function at some point. So that would be something I would really highlight. Another thing we're learning more about is, and there's a few people working on this, that systemic, so inflammation in the rest of your body, which is beautifully managed by exercise and, you know, eating well. We know that people with Down syndrome have extra kind of inflammatory conditions that they're vulnerable to. And one thing that's coming up more and more frequently is dental health. That inflammation in the mouth and the gums is leading to release of proteins in the blood, and eventually could activate inflammation in the brain. So there's a real interplay between everything below your neck and everything above your neck.
Yeah, I mean, you can see how when you talk about just exercise, being social, keeping your brain active, you know, but like stimulation, how that would make anybody, you know, at least, you know, mentally and physically your life better. But it seems kind of straightforward, but it's like you said, Lori, those kind of spots can be difficult for our community. You know, socially, we've sometimes set up a way to kind of, socialize maybe within ourselves and not like be included as much, or you know, when it comes to just stimulating the brain, as people may not have, you know, think that your child's going to read, so they don't really invest in that, and then they're not doing it, you know, like these things, or like with exercise, just told right away, low tone, and you know, don't play this sport or that sport. And so, and then food, like you said, I mean, we always talk about that. So it is really just a tough spot sometimes for people to have to really change everything. And that's where we're going, right? We're trying to change these misperceptions.
You're right. I mean, we talk about these things as like, oh, just do them. Right. But in actual fact, in the real world, it's not that easy. And I'm loving watching some of the amazing programs like Gigi's Playhouse, you know, more of these family-based grassroots types of organizations and foundations that are making a space for people with Down syndrome to do a lot of these activities together where those limitations, you know, are less of a hindrance. But you know what, that's a good thing to emphasize and something we need to really advocate for is, why can't we? Why isn't this? And there's no reason for it. There really isn't.
You know, things are presented to us like there's a victimization there. There's a non-participation. This is just what is going to happen. And I think the truth of the matter is that we participate. So what should these families, what should individuals with Down syndrome, like their husbands and wives, their children, what should they be looking at in their parents? What should they be looking at in their spouses? Are there what are the signs that come on, and then how do they seek treatment?
Yeah. So that's a really tough one. And actually, and sometimes what we see, certainly in our research participants, that they're showing changes in learning and memory 1 year, very subtle or very limited to some one kind of behavior. For example, a very common change in behavior, we're not talking about regression syndrome, which is a whole different ballgame, but it's changes in behavior, loss of joy in hobbies. Suddenly they, you know, folks don't want to do all the activities they used to really enjoy. And those might be the earliest signs that we see. And we'll see that person in our research study, and these changes are coming along. And then 16 months later, when we see them again, they're fine. And so it's really what we really need to do is tease out what is going on in that person's life that could lead to these behavioral changes that look like the earliest signs of dementia. Is it a vitamin D deficiency? Was there a loss of a family member? Was there a change in the living environment, the situation? So it's a real holistic approach. And to understand if somebody's in that earliest stage, and certainly in research studies, we have the benefit of, we can put together a whole bunch of MDs and neuropsychologists and researchers to say, we think it is. Whereas in a clinical setting, you have a doctor who may not have a lot of experience trying to make that diagnosis. So, but the thing I see that's even more puzzling, and I know the National Down Syndrome Society is working on this, is that people with Down syndrome when they're older are not getting access to the same drugs. Because there's a lot of hand waving if it's just, that's what it is and nothing you can do about it. And I really don't like that. I think things are going to get better. Certainly NIH and NICHD, NIA are all very, very committed to this effort. We have amazing Down syndrome programs, national, international, that are pushing forward this agenda to provide more support to families. And a lot of these foundations also include researchers like me who are learning things, and maybe they're not even published yet, but we can share that information to make things move faster and get things to families quicker.
I think it's just about advocacy. And when we're talking about independence, like as our individuals with Down syndrome get older, to give them that independence and to empower them to advocate for themselves. And when you're, it shouldn't be treated, and it is treated, but it shouldn't be treated. But I think we should move forward in assuming that it's not going to be treated differently because there's an extra chromosome there, and seek out those who see us as equal.
Exactly.
I did have two questions because we're talking about preventive and how to empower in a more holistic way. One, can you test for vitamin D deficiency? Is that something, because I feel like you can get a vitamin B shot whenever you want. How often can parents request that blood work? And then the second thing is, we also talk about brain stimulation is really important. You see a lot of individuals, Liam loves his iPad, and I love his iPad for like different reasons.
We all love the iPad.
Because honestly, I see its benefits as far as the language development and watching movies with closed caption. I see the apps that are available for different supports and services. But then there's that, you know, the same way that everyone entertains themselves on these devices. But it does stimulate your brain. Is that the right or wrong kind of stimulation for the brain?
I think I love the tablet. Frankly, I don't see any problem with these games on the tablet that really engage different kinds of learning ability. There's a really fantastic researcher here at UCI. His name is Craig Stark, and he published some beautiful data showing that playing Tetris activated parts of your brain. You could see real brain changes structurally that were good, that were associated with better learning and memory because of playing Tetris. So you can imagine that whole philosophy can be applied to multiple different games. I know we all, as parents, I hear you don't want your kid to be having a whole bunch of screen time. That's not healthy either. But, this is where I think we're things have changed so much that we have access to all these other activities that are good for your brain, maybe not good for your legs and your arms, but they're also good for coordination, building coordination. They can also be really good for developing social skills in terms of cooperative games, right? So I think it's great, frankly, and I love to play games myself. So I think it's wonderful, and but it won't, we still want to have that activity of going outside and playing. I think that's good.
And vitamin D, you can.
Yes, I'm sorry. Vitamin D. Yeah, that's a blood test, easily done. So, and this is especially, I think, for people who, we're in California, but for people who are not getting a lot of sun all the time, vitamin D levels can drop, and that does impact learning and memory ability. So, if you can imagine, just keep picking off all those little things that are easy to identify and treat. That just gives your whole body, you're in a much better place to support your brain. So when you do your basic labs, you can ask about getting those vitamin D levels. It's easily done.
When we think of that holy grail of, hey, we have a cure for dementia and Alzheimer's, is that something in your professional opinion that would happen like overnight, oh my gosh, we just found this thing? Or do you see a path of where it is? And do you feel that, I don't know, you can't really, maybe you can give us a timeline. I don't know.
But is the timeline, right?
Yeah. Our hope is that maybe the first people cured from dementia and Alzheimer's are alive today.
Yeah. And actually, we love to think that, don't we? I mean, it would be amazing. So when I think back to, for example, when the first paper came out describing a vaccine, immunotherapy, so antibodies that clear the beta amyloid from your brain. And that happened, I think, in the late 90s. And then from that time to now, we have an FDA-approved drug of an immunotherapy for Alzheimer's disease. So that took 20 years. If you look at the number of clinical trials and all the things that are in the pipeline to be tested, it's again exploded. So the more things we have in the pipeline, the better the chances that we're going to find something that works. So timeline wise, I think there's going to be some really, exciting clinical trials coming for people with Down syndrome this year. And we should, get some insights within a couple of years if they work really well. But just recognize there's always lots of things in the pipeline because it is a complicated disease. Alzheimer's disease is complicated. And I really don't think a single magical thing is going to work. I do really think it's going to end up being a bunch of things.
Well, Doctor, thank you so much for joining us today. Thank you for all of your insight and the humanity you've brought to your profession. It really is just wonderful to talk to you.
It's been a real pleasure talking to you, Stephen and Laurie, and thanks for all your really great questions.
Thank you.
Have a beautiful day. Thank you so much.
You too.
Please follow us on Twitter at If We Knew Then Pod, and you can drop us a line on our Facebook page at If We Knew Then Pod, or visit our website, ifwenewthen.com, to send us an email with questions and comments. And you can join our mailing list there and get alerts of future podcast episodes. All these links will be added to this episode's show notes. Thank you again, and we look forward to you joining us on the next episode of If We Knew Then.